time it seems like nowadays, somebody gets pitched inside or somebody gets whacked with a baseball, and they want to run out to the mound and beat the pitcher to death, or at least, you know, drop kick him or fight him or whatever. What was it like when you played? Did you expect to get knocked down after a home run, or was it more of a respect thing? Or?
Yeah, you back whenever I played, if a guy was getting knocked around pretty good, you could expect to get low bridged, as they called it, and to get brushed back or even hit with a pitch. And we used to always say, well, hell, I didn't hit the home run off him. The guy ahead of me did. But you more or less expected it and was ready to hit the dirt and get out of the way. Nobody ever gave it a thought, well, I might have given it a thought, but nobody went out to the mound to fight the pitcher. Now, the one way that they, some of the old guys would do, maybe the next time up, or that time up, he might drag a ball down towards first, and what he would try to do is time it and spike the pitcher as he come over to cover the base. Mm-hmm. I know guys like Fred Hutchinson, and I think I mentioned Ted Lyons, would throw at your feet or your ankles and stuff instead of trying to hit you in the head. And back then, we didn't have a helmet. I think a helmet today is one of the most wonderful things that happened as far as saving a guy from a terrible injury, mm-hmm. or maybe even death. They did come out with, after the war, they came out with a little insert that you put in your cap, being on the left-hand hitter, be on the right side of your cap. But it was nothing compared about how that helmet can serve you. Even running bases today, the players wear helmets, and there's been a few of them hit pretty good on that helmet, and it saved injury.
Mm-hmm. This is something that I didn't know, and by reading a book here recently, something that would be similar to getting knocked down or maybe getting the pitcher's anger up. But what about swinging on a 3-0 count? What did was there an unwritten rule back when you played that you, if you swung on a 3-0 count, that somehow this angered the pitcher?
Well, yeah, I think sometimes it angered them and everything, but usually it would anger your manager, because on a 3-0 count, he had you taken. But there were some guys that, like they have today, that can break up a ball game and win a ball game for you if they can discipline themselves to wait and get the good pitch. Now, what used to always worry me, like if a guy gave me the go-ahead, the green light on 3-0, I might get over-anxious and swing at a ball that I shouldn't swing at. If you get your pitch right down in there, now haul off and have a good cut at it. But like today, I see guys, big lead. They're stealing second. They're stealing third. They do that kind of stuff back then. They would be challenged and really, really, really go at them. And especially when a guy hits a home run. Like I see Barry Bonds and I see the different guys that stop at home plate, fill up their hands, and this and that. If they had done that, it would have been the biggest damn fight you ever seen, showing up that pitcher when he hit the home run. Now, another thing, they have a rule, like going down to second base, you can't get out of line going after that shortstop or second baseman. I think they ought to make a rule, but the same thing for that catcher. Whenever you have, and back when I played, there had been more fights with somebody 200 pounds running full speed, and the catcher has his back turned to him or his side, mm-hmm. waiting to catch a ball, and this guy doesn't slide in hard, he puts his head down, shoulder, mm-hmm. and hits him like he's a professional football player to really knock him over. You wouldn't have done that whenever I played. The catcher was supposed to give you part of the plate. When you come into the plate, you slid hard, your spikes up. Now, of course, he had the shin guards and everything on, but never, I've seen so many guys and get knocked over with somebody running full speed and you're standing there. Can you imagine if you were standing out here in the street and looking the other way and some guy come along, 200 and some pound guy, full speed and hit you? I'm surprised that there isn't more fights at home plate.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to protect the shortstop and second baseman, like you had a guy, Posse,
right,
in Cleveland, that Pete Rose ruined his career,
mm-hmm,
by coming in and doing that.
Speaking of, you talk about fights, any good fights that you were in or any good fights that you remember?
No, I was never in any. And we never had where you run out in the field and was having the big brawl like you see now, where everybody empties the bench and comes in.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have that, no.
How'd you get along with all your managers at Detroit? I know there was Del Baker and Steve O'Neill and Red Rolfe and Fred, mm-hmm, Hutchinson at the very end.
Okay, I got along with them fine.
Mm-hmm. How about front office people from the Briggs family on down?
Well, yeah, the Briggs family, of course, you know, after I was through playing ball, and I was doing some scouting for Detroit, and their Spike's son, Spike Briggs' son, Jimmy, loved baseball. In fact, he's been a coach at in college for years, and he would go on some of my tryout camp things. And when Jimmy got married, he had me as his best man. And his mother said to me, I tried to tell Jimmy to get somebody younger, but he wanted you, Pat. So I was Jimmy Briggs' best man at his wedding.
How about the press? How'd you get along with them?
Fine. Okay.
Any particular writers that you have anything to say about?
Oh, I don't know. It was...
Anybody that really treated you well or did you have fond memories of?
Well, I see. It was a guy like Leo McDonald. He was with the Times in Detroit then. Let's see. Of course, as a player, Joe Falls wasn't there when I was a player. We had a guy named Murphy was with had the Time and the News. Everybody treated me okay. And of course, they would write what they seen, and sometimes you don't like what you see, but you did it, you know,
mm-hmm,
or you weren't doing it.
It seems like nowadays you catch a little sound bite on television, and maybe the winning pitcher or somebody that had a big hit or something like that. In a clubhouse, there appears to be 15 or 20. Media people crowded around just this one guy, and there would have to be other ones roaming around at the same time too. What was it like when you played there? Was it baseball now? Every time somebody turns around, there's a film,
yeah,
clip or something.
Well, baseball has really, really changed there, where you might have a guy come in and talk to you and say something, you know, ask you a few questions and maybe congratulations on the kind of a game you had. But you're right. Today, there's you can't get around some of the people. If your locker happens to be next to this guy, you got to wait because it's really crowded with the TV and the, mm-hmm, press. Everybody there talking to him. I know when I was with Montreal as a coach, and we had that Bill, they called him Spaceman.
Bill Lee.
Bill Lee. Well, his locker was right next to mine. Well, sometimes I couldn't get to my locker because the people were there. He was a good guy for a good story and everything, and had always had something to say.
How about the fans? How'd the fans treat you?
I think that in my years with Detroit, that I feel awful thankful and happy the way the fans treated me there. I've had days where I would think to myself, go ahead, get on me. But they didn't. I guess they more or less felt that I was giving my best. I was hustling and bearing down. And sometimes even when you do that, you pile up.
How about, money? This is a great topic. I see, I think it was just in today's paper, Cal Ripken, 6 years, I believe it is, or 5 years, I believe it is, at $32.5 million.
Yeah.
What kind of money did Pat Mullen make when he played?
Well, my first year up, I was making $4,500. And I hit $345, I told you, and I broke my shoulder. I got my contract the next year, 1942, with a cut in salary. And I told you I went out to see him, the guy, and he said that you have any idea how much it costs to fix your shoulder. Well, then, my goodness, they had insurance and everything. But it just shows you, that's why, to me, more power to the ball player today to get what he can get. I was going to be cut because I broke my shoulder, and I was only making $4,500, and they're going to cut my salary and tell me how much it costs for the hospital bill. That's how tough it was.
What was the most you ever made in any 1 year?
18.
And what that year was, would that have been 1949 or?
Around 1950 or something like that, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, you talked about them wanting to cut your salary after you broke your shoulder. You're out on that. It's during a game. You're hustling the first. You're trying to avoid the pitcher who sprawled out on the first baseman.
Yeah.
This kind of falls underneath the category of maybe you were cheated a little bit, or maybe you were lied to a little bit, or let down. Or
well, that's what I say.
Anything besides
that? I said, if you make this ball club, we'll take care of you. Not a few hundred dollars, but more. Well, I asked him, I said, you think I made the club? He said, yeah. I said, I didn't think you could. I said, do you think I made it? He said, yes, you did. And he's going to give me a cut in salary. Now, I don't think I could have played that year, but it was I couldn't believe when he said, you know how much the hospital bill was for your shoulder.
Was the season? You played, I think, 10 seasons altogether.
Mm-hmm.
What was the season you remember the most, and why?
Well, I guess 1948, I had the best well-rounded-out year. You know, I hit 23 home runs. I think I scored 90 runs and had 88 RBIs or something like that. But going back to 41 when I first came up, and I was hitting 345, and everything I swung at was a base hit. And I'd even say to my wife on the way home, I said, boy, if it keeps going like this, you know, I couldn't believe it, I was doing that well. But in 48, I don't think I started the season in 48 either. Vic could throw better than me, Hoot Evers, and they had Suchok and those guys, other outfielders. So I become more of a utility man, fill in and stuff. And somebody, now Vic pulled something in his leg or something like, and I got in the lineup, and I come up with a real good year, see. Same thing happened in 47. I didn't start the season, but I made the All-Star team.
Mm-hmm. I just want to ask you about just a couple games in particular. How about the first night game you ever played at Tiger Stadium? I know you were in the game and you hit a home run.
Yeah.
It was June the 15th of 1948.
Yeah, you know, a guy wrote a book. He was talking about the first home run hit in the night game in Detroit. I thought I did. I really thought I hit first home run. But the guy in that book, I don't think he has me that, but he had it wrong for the 1941 season. It had Frank Sicori, who later on became a National League umpire,
mm-hmm.
and it had my name. When it had the stats for 41, and it had an X, played less than 10 games.
Not true.
So I called the guy up. The guy had called and talked to me. I called him up and said, hey, either you made a mistake or that guy did that. And I had the stats. I went to bat 200 and some times.
Mm-hmm.
It hit 345. I think I had 5 home runs. Is it on there?
Right. Yeah, 220 at bats, 5 homers, 23 RBIs. 345 hitter.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was in the book. He sent me the book. And there it was. It wasn't in there, see? And I think that I hit that first home run in that night game.
Was it a little strange? You had only played day games up to that point, and
yeah.
Here you are.
I played in the minor leagues.
I'm just talking about Briggs Stadium.
Like Briggs Stadium, of course, they had a wonderful lighting system, and you could sit out in the outfield and read a paper and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So it was a big change because a ball player back in my days always ate a big breakfast, and I still do. You get up in the morning, had breakfast, you went to the ballpark. You were there, you know, 11:30 or 12 o'clock, because you're going to have maybe a 2:30 game. So your big meal before the game was a good, hearty breakfast. And now when the night ball come up, it seemed like a long, long day waiting for the time to go to the ballpark to get ready for a night game.
How about Bill Veeck and Eddie Gaedel?
I'll tell you.
You were there that day.
Eddie Gaedel, I played in that game. It was the second game of a doubleheader, and they had a big affair. They had antique cars and everything else. They were showing off. Now, I'm playing center field. Vic Wirtz is in left. Right. A flatbed truck pulled up to home plate. There was a big cardboard box on it.
Mm-hmm.
Eddie Gaedel got out of the cardboard box. Went down to the plate to hit. Sugar Cane was pitching for us. Bob Swift was the catcher. And Ed Hurley was the umpire. Swift wanted to lay down to catch. The umpire wouldn't let him. Now, Gaedel just had one of them little souvenir bats that you buy. The umpire, Hurley, said something to Gaedel. He reached in his hip pocket. He got his contract in his hip pocket. Now, I thought it was a big joke, you know, and I'm hollering over to Vic. Play back in, over towards the line. He's swinging late. But he never took the bat off his shoulder. It was ball 4.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he went to first base, and they announced, you know, on the scoreboard, they're putting the pinch runner in for him. And I hollered to Vic, it counts. I was playing too deep. But I think they put a guy named Casco in the pinch run for him. But a guy sent me a copy of the lineups of that game. This guy was saving the box scores of that game, and he was trying to get everybody to play in that game to sign it. So when I got it, I had my son run off copies for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I had them in my briefcase when I'd be at spring training or something, and Lopat was saying, when he come up the second time, and the guy says, hey, Pat, you said he only come up once. I said, he only come up once. And then I showed them this thing. And I went 3 for 5 in the game. And they said, that's why you saved this. I said, no, this guy mailed it to me and I sent it back to him. But they accused me of saving that copy of that game because I had 3 hits. But Eddie Bedell only went to bat one time. And of course, like Beck had the big rocking chair when he had Satchel Paige and Sportsman Park, where he had the big rocking chair with the shade over it to sit down there and everything. Bill had things where he had the fans put up signs, bunt, hit and run, and stuff like that.
I think that was grandstand manager's name.
Yeah. And Zach Taylor was a manager.
Well, as a player, what did you think about Vec, about the stunts he used to pull? Do you got a kick out of him personally, or you thought it was bad for the game? I know the fellow owners didn't particularly care.
I know the owners didn't like him, but I liked him. When I was through playing ball and I first started the scout, I was working out of the front office in Detroit. And Bill Vec came into the front office. He was a good friend of Bill Norman, who became the manager of Detroit. And Bill would sit there and talk to Ed Catalinas, who was the scouting director of Detroit. And he'd be smoking a cigarette, and he had that wooden leg. And for an ashtray, he just put the ashes in that wooden leg. Now, when we went out to eat, Bill Norman, who was the manager always, he wanted me to eat with him. And, of course, Bill Vec was there. And they're talking and everything. Now they're going to close the place. And Bill said, well, let's get a case of beer. We'll sit out on the curb on the street in Detroit to drink it, you know. I guess the way he talked, he had done that many times. But then he decided, well, he couldn't do it because this lady that he married, I guess they had quite a few children. Maybe she had them before or something, I don't know. But he had to catch a private plane to get back to Cleveland because he always went to Mass. I think her name was Mary?
Mary Francis.
Mary Francis. Always went to Mass with Mary Francis. Mm-hmm. So he had to leave. But he was a real good friend of Bill Norman's.
1953, your last year with the Tigers, the record says 79 games, only 97 at-bats, which mm-hmm. sounds to me like a lot of maybe pinch-hitting duty or defensive
That's right.
replacement
Killing
or
in, yeah.
something like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I figured in some of those years where I was pinch hitting and I was filling in, I hit 12 home runs. I felt that if I would have played the year, that I'd have probably had some years where I had 30 home runs or maybe more. But just a few ball games that I get in, I come up with 12 home runs. You know, I think 2 or 3 times there. And 48, when I got in the game a little more, I come up with the 23. And I didn't start the season then, you know. But I think maybe I could have had a year where I hit 30.
Okay, so after 53... no more playing with the Tigers. How did you know, or how did they let you know, that as far as your major league playing days, that they were over?
Well, I got a call. You know, I could see I wasn't getting to play much in 54, in spring training. My mother was very sick, and I left spring training and come home. My mother passed away. I went back to spring training, and they called me upstairs and told me they wanted me to go to Buffalo as a player coach with Bill Hitchcock. And I said to him, you mean when you put me on waivers, nobody claimed me? And he said, no. And So I say in the organization, if the salary that I signed for, went to Buffalo as a player coach with Bill, and I think it was sometime in June, Bill Norman was managing Little Rock, our AA club. He quit. And I got a call, Spike Briggs, for me to go to Little Rock as a player manager. So I went down there, the player manager, Little Rock. And it was the next year, I think, that I went to Idaho Falls as a player manager. But that's how I found out. They called me upstairs and told me that I was gone. And it's, you know that day is coming,
mm-hmm.
but you can't believe it when you hear them telling you this is it.
So the adjustment for you from playing baseball to life after baseball into to Idaho Falls and into Jamestown and beyond, easy for you or not so easy?
Well, it was hard at first not to be in the major leagues, but I really enjoyed after I was a player manager and everything, then I become a scout for Detroit, and we had tryout camps all throughout Michigan, and it was more or less of a publicity thing. We went to Grand Rapids, and now I see that Campbell on ESPN.
Mm-hmm.
I had him in the tryout camp in Lansing, Michigan,
mm-hmm.
when he was in high school. So I got all those guys, and now they call me up to be a coach with Detroit, 63 to 66. Dressen died, Ball Swift died. Then I was going to go back into the minor leagues because they had a complete change. Mayo Smith came in as a manager and all new coaches. Adcock became the manager at Cleveland. He called me and he said, "Pat, I want you as my coach." And I said, Joe, he said, "I know, you know, you've been with Detroit all these years and everything." I didn't really know Joe, only coaching at first base. And I'd say to the guy, "This guy has a good move. There's so many out. And watch old folks here. He's got a bag of tricks." That's Adcock, see. So I went to Cleveland as a coach. One thing, it was another year towards the pension plan.
Mm-hmm.
Joe's first year, he had a 2-year contract, but they let him go at the end of the year. Well, Gabe, Paul, and Peters had me upstairs. They talked wonderfully to me, very, very nice and everything. And makes you feel as though you'd ask for a raise,
mm-hmm.
but I was gone. only one they kept was George the shortstop. But he's the only one they kept. Alvin Darkman is the manager. Mm-hmm. So then I scouted 1 year for Cleveland. Then at the World Series, I'm sitting in the press room, and the Washington Senators general manager came up to me and said, "Pat, Jim Lemon is going to be the manager of Washington." He said, "Jim needs a coach." And Jim and I had been to Germany on a baseball clinic thing. I got to know Jim. And Selkirk was the general manager. And McHale was going to be the guy, the head man in Montreal. Now, he was there in Detroit when I was. So he said, "Pat, they're waiting for you in Montreal." So I didn't hear from Miguel, but I heard from Selkirk and Jim Lemon. So I signed with the Washington Senators as a coach. The I went to Myrtle Beach on a golf trip with my friends, about 12 of us. Some of the guys got in later than what we did, and they said, "Hey, Pat, we heard on the radio that they fired Selkirk." See, Short bought the ball club. I said, "How'd that affect you?" I said, "I don't know." The next morning, it's in the paper, they let Lemon go. There's the two guys that hired me, see? So I went to spring training, and they hired Ted Williams as the coach, the manager. I went to spring training, and Ted said, "Pat, how did you get with Washington?" And I told him. And Ted was, and I don't blame him, was trying to get men that he wanted to be his coaches. And so he said something about going to Buffalo as a AAA manager and stuff. And I said, "No." I was a little bit peeved. I said, "No, I signed as a coach. And now if I'm going to go." So one day I looked up and there was Billy Hitchcock. He was with Montreal then. And another Montreal guy. And they were talking to Ted, and I was going out to the field. Ted came out the outfield and said, "Pat, those guys want you. They want you over there to help run their minor league camp and do this and do that." And he said, "We need somebody like that in our organization." I said, "Well," I told him, "how much it would take and everything." And when I seen Ted, I said, "You talked to Mr. Short?" He said, "Yeah." He said he wasn't Rockefeller. I didn't ask for that much, hardly anything. Mm-hmm. And of course, I tried to talk to Short, and he'd be talking to people. He knew I was waiting to talk to him. And he'd keep talking to these people, and then he'd walk away. He treated me shabby, Short. So I went to Montreal. I was 69. And I worked for them in spring training and everything. I scouted for them. Then they made me their minor league hitting instructor. Well, I go around all the ball clubs. And, of course, they brought me up as a coach. 79, 80, and 81 is major league, minor league hitting coach. And like when I watch ball games now, there's Tim Raines making $2 million. I had him his first year. Mm-hmm. Andre Dawson, had him. Jim Wallach, Galarraga. I had Valentine, who's no longer in baseball.
Gary Carter?
Huh?
Gary Carter?
Gary Carter. Had him their first year. And like Carter still tries to pull everything, mm-hmm. You know. And he had a batting practice. If he didn't hit five out, bad batting practice. Mm-hmm. Not doing what George Kell did. Hit over here and there. Because he had power enough to hit it over the right field fence. So I went down to see a game in Montreal, down here at Pittsburgh. And I got down in the runway, and I had some friends of mine with me, and here comes Tim Raines. He said, "Pat, I always try to do what you told me. I always remember." I said, "What did I tell you, Tim?" "You told me I could never make a ball club laying on a training table or sitting on the bench. Hurt." He said, "I remember that." He said, "I played with a thumb that was broken." I said, "Tim, I didn't know when I was talking to you. I was talking to the guy who was going to make $2 million a year." I said, "In fact, I brought a bushel basket down with me. I want to get a loan." But I always watched, like Casey Candel playing with Houston. I watched him, and then I say, "Now see if he's left-handed, if he's choking up about that much." And watch him, and he's choking up. Because he was at West Palm Beach. And I said, "Casey, you think you ever get to the big leagues because you get 30 home runs a year?" He said, "No, Pat." I said, "Well, you have to be a pesky type of hitter. You got to spray that ball all fields, lay down a bunt, drag, anything, get on base. And I got him a thing that you put on a bat that you can't get out further. And he said, I watch him now. He's not hitting much, but he's a valuable guy to that ball club. He plays infield, outfield, any place they put him, you know. So it's sometimes you have to have guys like that to fill in, you know.
Okay, yeah. Montreal, 79, 80, 81, and then you said you retired in 85.
Yeah.
Fill in the years there.
Well, see, I still went around and from 81, 82, 83, 84, and 85 I didn't work. I still went around all our minor league clubs. Like Felipe Liu was a minor league manager, mm-hmm. and we were together in spring training, and I came in his club and worked with the hitters. I know they, one year when I was up at the big club, they sent me to Memphis, Tennessee. I joined them in Knoxville. They had signed Terry Francona. Good hitter. They wanted him to hit for power. So every morning we took the bus and went out to the ballpark in Knoxville. And everything can carry a swing. Beautiful swing. And of course, in my report, I put, I'd rather see him hit 350, which he was hitting, 350 and hit 10 home runs, and then hit 245 and hit 25 home runs. Mm-hmm. He's not that type of hitter, power hitter. And then he goes to Denver, and I was in Denver. And he had this beautiful swing, and he stepped by the other. I said, that's what you have to do on the inside pitch. So he pulled one foul in Mile High Stadium. There was a door open high up on the wall, and went right in that door. And jokingly, I said to him, hey, Terry, if you stick with me, doors will open for you. Now they brought him up to the big leagues. And of all people, Suter was pitching. He hit a home run off Suter. Now all the guys are giving him the high fives and stuff like that. And as he come by me, he said, hey, Pat, doors will open for me. I said, yeah, they'll open for you.
How about you? How about your life here? My father-in-law told me about the Oldsmobile dealership. Mm-hmm. Tell me about what you've done around here since your playing days were over.
Well, I haven't done anything. I haven't done anything but go to the golf course every day. Mm-hmm. I get up in the morning and I either cook my breakfast. See, my wife passed away a year ago in July. It's been awful hard, but I get my breakfast, so I go out and eat. And I go out to the golf course. This guy that owns the golf course, about 6 years ago, he gave me a life membership, and I don't pay for carts. There's not enough words in the dictionary to thank a man for something like that. So I go out and play and everything. And, I think I'd go crazy if I just sat around the house here all the time, see. I could have stayed in as a scout with Montreal. But when they say just scout around home and this and that, it doesn't turn out to be that way. You're on the road, you're here and you're there. And for the way they were going to cut me down in salary and everything, I said, hell, the money that they throw away on guys that Christ can't hardly walk the first, I got out of it.
Let me add just two more questions, Pat. The first one. Your fondest memory or moment playing baseball could be from any time, back in the early days around here all the way to Detroit.
Well, I think like the first day that I walked on a Major League Baseball diamond was in the starting lineup. It was really a thrill and thing that ambition that had come true. And then when we were talking about me pinch hitting and filling in and stuff like that, I hadn't started a game for 40 days. Red Roth was the manager. We had a doubleheader in New York. I walked into the ballpark and they said, Pat Red wants to see you. Well, you know, when you're in a spot like I was, you're either traded, sold, or they're going to release you. He said, whatever game they pitch a right-hander today, I'm going to give Johnny Groth a rest. It was the second game of a doubleheader. First time up, Vic Rashi's pitching. First time up, home run. Second time up, I hit one end of the bat, beat it out. And they brought in Spec Shea. Come up, home run. Then I got walked. And like Dizzy Trout would say when we got back to Detroit, I didn't realize that the first time I ever heard 68,000 people, home people, boo their home pitcher. I walked twice. And I hit another home run. 4-for-4. I'm the next hitter. And Johnny Lippon hit into a double play. It was a slugfest game, 12-8 or something like that. Now, I could, if one more time at bat, I could have maybe popped up or struck out. But if I hit another home run, I think there's only 12 or 14 guys that have hit 4 home runs in a game. Mm-hmm. You know? So I was that close. I hit 3. And I didn't think there was hardly anybody who did that. So I looked up the records, and my God, there's a list that long of guys hit 3 in a game. But that was a big thrill.
Okay, last one. If you could go back and change maybe one thing that happened or you were involved in or something like that, do you have anything that you would change or just leave it exactly the way that it happened?
Well, I think that one thing that if that I would change that, knowing what I know now, that I would not been so aggressive in trying to pull all the pitches that I was trying to pull. Man, when I become a hitting instructor and I had the kids and I was telling them, you know, to go with the pitch and this and that, I would tell them, I can tell you, as a good example, I hit 38 home runs a year, foul. Foul. You know, and they don't count. But I think that, me as a hitting coach, what I would tell Gary Carter, Tim Wallach, and all those guys, to go with the pitch. If you have power, thank God you have it. That pitcher's going to make enough mistakes, he's going to beat from the center of the plate in for you to hit it out. And like Wallach, of course, he's a low ball, uppercut type of a swinger. I try to get him to swing here, you know, up in here. I said, Tim, you'll be a superstar if you do that. But that swing up like this, they're going to pitch him up through here. And, you know, his average is down. He's in about 240 or something like that, see. But I think that if Tim ever got to where he would here instead of this kind of a swing, if he would level it off, stay on top with his power and everything, and my God, he'd be a superstar.
Pat, thank you very, very much for your time today.
Okay, Rich.